Following the end of World War I, the war declared to be the war to end all wars, King Albert I of Belgium made a visit to one of the bloody battlefields on which thousands of young men died. He was so appalled by the slaughter that occurred there that he ordered one of the iron cannonballs found on the field to be melted down and cast into four watch cases. Four fine watch movements were then inserted inside each of the cases. King Albert's plan was to present each of the four watches to the four men that he believed made the greatest contributions to world peace. One watch was given to Field Marshal Ferdinand Foch, the Allied Supreme Commander in 1918. The second went to Commander-in-Chief of the American Expeditionary Force, General John J. Pershing. The third was given to Premier Georges Clemenceau, the inspiring French leader who encouraged his nation and others during the dark days of that horrific war. Four decades passed, and King Albert was unable to find a man worthy of receiving his last watch. He then passed it to his son to find such a man. And in 1970, King Leopold III found him and presented the last of the four watches to Herbert W. Armstrong. Upon accepting this gift, Mr. Armstrong said, "I feel it was the highest honor the king could have paid anyone. Whatever contribution to world peace I may be making is not through war, but through education, teaching millions worldwide the way to peace." In 1984, Herbert Armstrong came to China, where he had an audience with some of the top leaders of the nation. Who was this remarkable man? And what did he say when he met the Honorable Deng Xiaoping? Stay tuned. Herbert W. Armstrong was known as an unofficial ambassador for world peace. Until his death in 1986 at the age of 93, Mr. Armstrong traveled the globe speaking with many of the world's most important leaders about the meaning of life and about the way of peace. Among his acquaintances were Emperors Hirohito and Haile Selassie. He visited with kings and queens from such diverse countries as Thailand, Spain, and Belgium. He had private audiences with presidents, prime ministers, high-level cabinet officials, and business leaders from Asia, Africa, North America, and Europe. He was good friends with Prime Ministers Golda Meir, Yitzhak Rabin, and Menachem Begin of Israel. Yet he was equally the friend of Israel's traditional enemies, Presidents Anwar Sadat and Hosni Mubarak of Egypt, and King Hussein of Jordan warmly received him. Mr. Armstrong understood that all of man's efforts to bring peace have failed and will continue to fail miserably, because the way of peace has not been known by man. And Mr. Armstrong well understood that he would not bring peace to this earth. He believed that peace would come, but not through the efforts of any man. He understood that a change of man's nature would have to first take place. General Douglas MacArthur described man's state most eloquently in a radio address to the world on September 2, 1945. following the Japanese surrender aboard the battleship USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay. Men since the beginning of time have sought peace. Military alliances, balances of power, leagues of nations, all in turn failed, leaving the only path to be by way of the crucible of war. We have had our last chance. If we do not now devise some greater and more equitable system, Armageddon will be at our door. The problem basically is theological and involves a spiritual recrudescence and improvement of the human character that will synchronize with our almost matchless advances in science, art, literature, and all material and cultural developments of the past 2,000 years. It must be of the spirit if we are to save the flesh. In speaking to the Honorable Deng Xiaoping, as he spoke with other leaders, Herbert Armstrong explained that there are only two ways of life. The first is the way of give, of outgoing concern for the other person. The second is the way of get, taking care of number one with little or no regard for the other person. Man by nature is self-centered and selfish. He looks out for himself. According to the book known as the Bible, God placed the first man and the first woman that he fashioned and formed in a garden that was filled with plants and animals of all kinds. Among the trees that bore fruit, there were two special ones. One was called the tree of life, and it symbolized God's rule over man. By partaking of it, man would be looking to God to show him the difference between right and wrong. In short, how to live in harmony with God and fellow man. And it would lead to eternal life. The other tree was called the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and Adam was warned to stay away from it. Notice, and the Lord God commanded the man, saying, "Of every tree of the garden you may freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it you shall surely die." This tree symbolized mankind taking upon himself the right to determine what is good and what is evil. And to choose this tree meant pain, heartache, suffering, conflict, and death. On the surface, the choice seems rather simple. But our human nature is such that we do not want God telling us what to do. We would rather decide for ourselves, and that is exactly what Adam and his wife Eve did. There is a real spirit world, and Satan the devil appeared to Eve in the form of a serpent and challenged God's statement that by eating of that tree, it would lead to death. Notice how he flattered her and played on her vanity. Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened or enlightened. And you will be like God, knowing good and evil." In effect, he told her that God was unfair, that he was lying to her, that she did not need God, and that she should be able to make up her own mind concerning her lifestyle choices. The tactic worked. So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was pleasant to the eyes and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. Herbert Armstrong often spoke of these two trees and boiled the message down to the two ways of life. Give, outgoing concern for the other fellow, or get, self-interest and disregard for the other person. This is no doubt the subject about which he spoke to the Honorable Deng Xiaoping. Sadly, whether we are talking about two people in marriage, about neighbors, about nations, there is far too much self-interest and far too little outgoing concern. And thus we have the problems that we face today. In order for there to be real peace, there must be a change in our very nature. Former U.S. President Richard Nixon well understood the world and how it operates. He understood the mind of man on a geopolitical scale. and how self-interest is at the heart of every nation's foreign policy. In his book, Real Peace, Mr. Nixon chided poets, authors, and songwriters about their dreamy ideas of peace. Those who make peace at the typing table rather than at the negotiating table have the luxury of being peacemakers without having to grapple with complex problems in the rough and tumble world of real international diplomacy. To them, the only obstacle to peace is a regrettable lack of leaders who are as selfless and idealistic as they claim to be, and who are willing to put aside parochial national interest in the interest of bringing peace to the world. They hope that this era will be the one in which self-interest, the force that has driven history since the dawn of history, will simply evaporate. Mr. Nixon also recognized that the problem is man's nature, but he never placed hopes on religion to come to the rescue. In the long term, we can hope that religion will change the nature of man and reduce conflict. But history is not encouraging in this respect. The bloodiest wars in history have been religious wars. Men praying to the same God killed each other by the thousands in the American Civil War, and by the millions in World War I and World War II. Unless men change, a real peace must be built on the assumption that the most we can do is to learn to live with our differences rather than dying over them. Neither did Herbert Armstrong look to religion to come to the rescue. He recognized, as Mr. Nixon did, that religion is too often part of the problem. When our first parents chose the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they were thrust out of the Garden of Eden. God, in effect, told them, "Go, do your own thing." Ever since, whatever man has put his hand to build has been a mixture of good and evil. Education teaches how to make a living, but not how to live. Science and technology can take us to the moon, but in the end stand as the Frankenstein monster that can destroy all life from this planet. All that man touches can have a good application, but too often it is used for evil. We have become slaves to email and texting. Television and computers are used to spread pornography. We spend huge sums of money around the world for health care, but do not know the way to good health. Governments are run by kings, presidents, parties, committees, congresses, and parliaments, but none has brought us lasting peace. And when man forms God in his own image, even religion is an enemy to peace. In 1959, the former Soviet Union donated to the United Nations a bronze statue of a man holding a hammer in one hand and a sword in the other, into which he is shaping a plowshare. This work of art, called "Let Us Beat Swords into Plowshares," symbolizes man's desire for an end to war and conflict, and the conversion of the instruments of war into instruments of peace. Where did the idea of this magnificent piece of work come from? Do you know? The answer is the Bible. Notice it in Micah, the 4th chapter, verse 3. "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore." These are truly beautiful words, and they are no doubt the dream of much of the human race. What a wonderful world it would be if this passage were to be true today. But is this merely the stuff of the typing table, as Richard Nixon put it? Is such a peace possible? While some know that the title to this statue originates in the Bible, few know the actual context of the passage. What will it take for men to beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks? What will cause nations to put down their swords and close their war colleges? As Mr. Nixon rightly points out, it won't be the negotiating table, nor will it be religions of man's making. Oddly, while he was considered an ambassador for world peace, Herbert Armstrong knew that peace would never come by his or any other man's efforts, but in spite of man's efforts. So while he spoke about a way of peace, he had no illusions that man would change his nature. He knew that man's only hope for peace would be a strong hand from someplace, as one source once referred to it. Only then will there be a supreme arbiter between nations, and only then will there come about a change in human nature. It is not something that we will choose to do, but something that will be done in spite of us. Yet peace indeed will come. Here's a more complete quote from Micah, the part people are not so familiar with, and the part that explains how peace is going to come. Now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain or the government of the Lord's house shall be established on the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above the hills, and people shall flow to it. Many nations shall come and say, come and let us go up to the mountain or the government of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He shall judge between many peoples and rebuke strong nations afar off. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. In the remainder of the program, we will examine how and when real peace will come. The pages of the Bible predict a time of trouble such as the world has never seen. The Bible is worthy of your trust and respect, and you can prove it as such. Do you realize that it is actually predicted that mankind will come near to destroying all life from this earth? Something that even now is possible. Notice it in Matthew, the 24th chapter and verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. Yes, man will actually come to that point. That is the bad news, but there is also good news, wonderful news. That is when the God of heaven is going to step in to save man from himself and in spite of himself. That is when the prophesied Messiah of the Jews is going to step in. That event is also known in the biblical scriptures as the second coming of Jesus Christ. And he will do for man what man cannot do for himself, bring lasting peace. When he comes back this time, he is not going to come as a meek lamb led to the slaughter or crucified. No, he is going to come as a conquering king with the power to enforce peace. Biblical prophecies tell us there is coming a confrontation in the Middle East, where many nations will come against the Jewish state known as Israel. At that time, God will intervene and fight for the Jews, set up a kingdom, and command all nations to come and learn his ways. Sounds strange, doesn't it? But look at the world today. What do you see? Look at the state of affairs in the Middle East. How could anyone know 2,500 years in advance that Jews would be in Jerusalem at this time, and that Jerusalem would be the center of today's geopolitical troubles? After all, the Jews were not in control of that city for hundreds of years. Yet that is exactly what the prophet Zechariah predicted over 2,500 years ago. Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of drunkenness to all the surrounding peoples when they lay siege against Judah, the Jews, and Jerusalem. And it shall happen in that day that I will make Jerusalem a very heavy stone for all peoples. All who would heave it away will surely be cut in pieces, though all the nations of the earth are gathered against it. Zechariah even tells us that when these nations come against Jerusalem, they will only take half the city, indicating that it will be a divided city at the end of the age, part Jewish and part not. Notice again, "Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, and your spoil will be divided in your midst. For I will gather all the nations to battle against Jerusalem. The city shall be taken, the houses rifled, and the women ravished. Half of the city shall go into captivity, but the remnant of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. And in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which faces Jerusalem on the east. And the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west." Zechariah then shows us that the survivors who fight against God in Jerusalem are going to be persuaded by God's control of nature to come up and learn that God's way leads to peace. "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. And it shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, on them there will be no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up in the inner end, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Lord strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." While this world is not going to know peace until that time comes, you can know peace in your personal life. You can live at peace with your family. You can be a peacemaker among your fellow workers. You can treat your employees with respect or serve your employer as you would want to be served. Yes, you can be at peace with your neighbor and with yourself. But all this takes work. It does not happen by chance. As already stated, there are really only two opposing ways of life: give and get. The give way, that is, the way of outgoing concern for others, is summed up in what is called the Golden Rule. "Therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them." Jesus also instructs us, "It is more blessed to give than to receive." Or as the Apostle Paul counsels, "Repay no one evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it is possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, 'Vengeance is mine, I will repay,' says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you will heap coals of fire on his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good." A practical example of this is given by the late syndicated columnist Sidney Harris in the book, Why Am I Afraid to Tell You Who I Am? He tells of the time when he was visiting a friend in New York and how they went out to buy a newspaper. The vendor at the stand was quite rude to Harris's friend. As they walked away, Mr. Harris asked his friend, "He was very rude to you. Is he always that way?" To which his friend replied, "Oh, yes, he is always that way." "Then why were you so nice to him?" And his friend replied, "Because I don't want him dictating to me how I will live my life." This man was clearly at peace with himself. In this case, he did not change the news vendor, but neither did he make war with him. And this brings us to a major cause of conflict in this world, both between individuals and between nations, and that is pride. Mr. Harris's friend, whether he realized it or not, was following the Apostle Paul's advice, and he was also swallowing his pride, something else the Bible instructs. But we'll have to leave that for another time. If you would like to learn more about today's program, please go to our website shown on the screen at this time. There you will find a variety of booklets and articles that show the way to peace. you will also find the booklet, The Bible, Fact or Fiction. It explains that you can really rely on this remarkable book to teach you the way to live in harmony with heaven and your fellow man. The Bible is worthy of your trust and respect, and you can prove it as such. In addition to promoting a harmonious life, it is also a book of history and a book that announces history in advance. So check out our booklet, The Bible, Fact or Fiction, and prove it for yourself. And be sure to come back next week, same place, same time, to learn more about tomorrow's world, when real peace will be a reality.
If you would like to discover more about how today's topic impacts your life, then take the time to examine the free literature offered on this program at tomorrowsworldhk.com. Find real answers to life's most puzzling and challenging questions at tomorrowsworldhk.com. At our website, you'll find valuable articles revealing God's principles for living an abundant and happy life, while providing rare insight into current and future events. So don't delay. Visit us now at tomorrowsworldhk.com.
The preceding program is produced by the Living Church of God.